pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Peggy, you want to call the roll?
Mr. Adams?
Present.
Mr. Batson?
Here.
Mr. Gibney?
Here.
Mr. Greiner?
Here.
Mr. Howell?
Here.
Mr. Kesselwing is excused. Mr. Schott?
Here.
We have a quorum, sir.
Very good. You want to read the notes?
Cases heard by the Planning and Zoning Commission will be presented to City Council in accordance with the schedule provided after each case in the agenda. Please note that the City Council meetings will begin at 4:00 p.m. and are held at City Hall, City Council Chambers, second floor, located at 151 Southeast Osceola Avenue.
Thank you. Next consideration of minutes. Everybody get a chance to look at them. I know there was a correction. We got another, a revised correction in the email. Everybody get to see that?
I'll make a motion to approve as submitted in the second email.
Okay, very good. Have a motion for approval?
Second.
And a second. No comments? Call the roll.
Okay. Mr. Adams?
Aye.
Mr. Howell?
Aye.
Mr. Batson?
Aye.
Mr. Gibney?
Aye.
Mr. Schott?
Aye.
Mr. Greiner?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Very good. All right, we'll get right into it for subdivision, Magnolia Villas West.
Karen Cupp, City Growth Management Department, 201 Southeast 3rd Street, 2nd floor. Before you is the final plat for the Magnolia Villas West. This is the final area of land to be platted in what is known as the Magnolia Subdivision, which is located between Merritt Camp and Southeast 24th Road. The infrastructure has been completed since approximately 2008, and developer had requested extensions for the time frame to submit the final plat. He was granted that in December of 2008, extending the expiration date of the improvement plan approval to 2010. And then under a Senate bill extension, he was granted an additional 2 years, extending the final date to submit the final plat to December of 2012. We received the initial plat for review in March of 2011. Staff comments were made. The plat before you has made the changes recommended by staff. And it is currently undergoing final legal review along with the developer's agreement. The developer's agreement has also been updated to address the infrastructure being in the ground and providing for an inspection to be done in coordination with the city inspectors. To make sure that the infrastructure is fully in working condition and prior to city acceptance of the public improvements, which will be water and sewer systems. The roads and the drainage retention system facilities will be privately maintained by the Homeowners Association. The engineering department is recommending approval subject to final legal review.
Very good. Any questions? No questions? Thank you. Is the petitioner here? Like to add anything? Do anything? Yeah. All right. Open up for public comment. Anybody have anything to say for or against this? Step forward. All right. Bring it back up here to the board.
I guess I'd have a question just for staff. Is it usual? I mean, do we usually construct sidewalks as the individual residences are constructed? Is that normal course of events?
The prior developments within the Magnolias had posted a bond. We have found that with today's economy, getting a bond or a letter of credit to bond sidewalks to be constructed as the homes are built was a little bit out of the norm for now. So we've built language in here. And yes, typically they would request to build the sidewalks with the home so as not to tear them up. However, after this subdivision had gone through approval of conceptual and improvement plans, the code was changed to for future subdivision developments to construct all sidewalks with the road improvements. But this one was more or less grandfathered in. We did have language in a prior version of the draft developers agreement to allow them to bond but we've since come up with an amendment that allows us to restrict the COs on the houses that require sidewalks.
Okay, thanks.
Good. Good. Anybody else? All right. We have a motion or anything?
I'll make a motion to approve as submitted.
I'll second.
All right, got a motion for approval and a second. Any discussion? Call the roll.
Mr. Adams?
Aye.
Mr. Betzel?
Aye.
Mr. Gibney?
Aye.
Mr. Howell?
Aye.
Mr. Schott?
Aye.
Mr. Greiner?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Very good. All right, moving on to the comp plan text amendment. Mr. Daniels?
Mike Daniels, City Growth Management Department. The public hearing that we have today is related to the two workshops that we've had with the Planning and Zoning Commission regarding making changes to the comprehensive plan to make it consistent with the Ocala 2035 vision. Since we've met the last time, we have made some changes to the future land use element by going back and bringing in all of the existing future land use policies, bringing that into the complete policy. And we've also brought in a goal for historic preservation. So those are two of the areas that we've added, as well as other revisions. And we have made changes to the future land use map. I've also added the existing historic preservation element and the existing community redevelopment area element, which we are proposing to eliminate. I've submitted the map series for both future land use and transportation. And with that, I'll turn it over to Curtis Strotka from VHB Miller Sellen for his presentation.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be back and see everyone again. Are you seeing this on your monitors?
No.
Nope.
Not yet? Okay.
City of Ocala logo.
You guys have done a fantastic job with that logo.
Okay, for the record, Curtis Stratka with VHB Miller Sellen, 225 East Robinson in Orlando. As Mike said, this is a request for to amend three different elements of the plan and delete two of them. As you know, the city went through a very long visioning process in the fall of 2010, and in order to implement that vision, we've started with the comprehensive plan. Wanted to bring up to speed on all the outreach and meetings we've done to date. We've had continuous meetings with the 2035 Vision Leadership Group. We had a focus group with local developers and attorneys. Some of them are here tonight, and we're very interested in hearing their comments. Later on in October, met with the Ocala Historic Preservation Advisory Board in November, had a public workshop at the Old Downtown Library in December to present the draft plan amendments. Met with the TPO in January, and as you all remember quite fondly, I'm sure, we had two meetings with this commission as well as a workshop with City Council most recently. Brings us to today. The first element we are looking at is the future land use element. As we said before, everything starts with the 2035 vision. It leads the way. So what we've done is put it at the very beginning of the future land use element. It's now goal one, to create and sustain a great place to live, play, and prosper. And we've created 10 new objectives at the beginning of the future land use element that describe the implementation of the 2035 vision. Probably the most significant of those for most people will be the new future land use categories that we'll go into a great deal about. The existing future land use policies from the old plan are incorporated behind the new sections as objectives 11 through 19. So what we've done is we've tried to make sure that we preserve everything, everybody's development rights from before, to make sure nobody's losing anything. You know, there are no property rights being taken away. That's very important to remember. And then those older policies could be further refined as the city goes through its evaluation and appraisal report-based amendments, which will occur. Is that going to be in the next year, Mike?
Yes.
The actual amendments for that. So the proposed 2035 future land use map, again, we wanted to be consistent with the community's adopted 2035 vision plan, which was a community drawing of how they saw the city developing over the next 25 years to respect existing development rights. We know there's a lot of current activity. There are a lot of development orders, projects in process that you know, we need to respect and make sure we don't affect them. And also to simplify the city's future land use map, there's 17 land use categories right now. What we've been able to do is bring that down to 7 categories, and I'll describe them each in more detail, but this is the proposed map. We've been through many different iterations with staff. This is substantially similar to the map that we brought to the commission and to city council in our last meetings. And have it up here for reference. So without ado, I'll tell you what's in this. There's 7 different land use categories, the central core being the red portion of the map, and I'll show exhibits of each of these, with the most density and intensity anywhere in the city of Ocala. And then it starts to trend to lesser intensity in the medium intensity or special districts, 5 to 30 units per acre, and with a less FAR amount there. Low intensity, again, we're decreasing in both density and intensity or floor area ratio. Neighborhood is a more residential-oriented land use district, which we see in the purple sections on the future land use map. Why don't I go into the different exhibits? This here shows how we are doing the current zoning and how it transitions under each of the future land use categories. As of right now, none of the zoning has changed, although staff is looking at also at ways to reduce the number of zoning categories down from 35 or so down to 15, again, to provide more flexibility for property owners, for developers, for applicants, and also for the city to administer. But again, the intent of that exercise is not to take away any development rights. It's just to shrink the amount of zoning categories that you all would have to consider. So the central core land use was the high intensity use on the 2035 vision. It's, as you can see, the center of the city, including the historic downtown square. But also extending north into the Magnolia Community Redevelopment Area, south towards the Medical District. It's the area that has the greatest amount of development allocated to it in terms of both residential and non-residential uses. And I wanted to point out that it also, you can see how it bridges over Pine 441 here, because the intent of the vision was to create a more unified community, so it's not, you know, West versus East Ocala, but to find a way to bring those together and create a central business district that incorporates both. The special district or medium intensity are the orange colors you see on the map, and those are more community center oriented. So they're not as big as downtown, but they're not low density developments either along the corridors. Each of them are unique. They all have different geographies, function, and what we've done is we've described them separately in the as a policy of the future land use element. But the key here is that they're community serving. They're not supposed to be regional, you know, centers of activity, but something that supports the local neighborhoods and community. So within Objective 8 of the plan, there are 11 different special districts described. The 5 on the left are within the West Ocala plan, and that's a process we went through with staff over the last 6 months or so, working very close with a steering committee from that community, and they designated those 5 areas of the city as of their community as of those of greatest importance. Crosskey Commons represents the area around the Martin Luther King Park at the intersection of 40 and MLK. So what they did is they identified the priority places where they would like to see development, and those were them. We also worked with staff to identify some other special districts. There's seven listed there, and they're in various areas of the city. 36 in Mary Camp. This is the 25th Avenue and 4th King Street, for example. And those districts would be further defined in a community planning process similar to the one that the West Ocala community went through. So that would be the opportunity for those neighborhoods, those businesses, those residents to participate in a smaller and specific planning process rather than the citywide one that we've done through the vision and the comprehensive plan. The low intensity district is you could call it your conventional suburban district, where you can see it occurs primarily along the 200 corridor. It's an area of like where the automobile takes primary importance over the needs of the pedestrian. So it's a more conventional suburban approach. Design guidelines would not be required here, although they may be encouraged by the comprehensive plan. The neighborhood district, the purple areas, are for the existing and future residential neighborhoods of the city. When we started this process, we didn't have it, but we quickly recognized the need of having a almost purely residential category to protect the existing neighborhoods and make sure that they aren't encroached by non-residential development. But it does allow for some limited neighborhood supportive retail or office, as long as it's compatible with the form and function of the community or of the neighborhoods. So there are some policies that control what kind of non-residential development you can have in there. For example, you're not allowed to strip out an entire street and make it look like a standard highway corridor. It has to be compatible with the existing nature of that neighborhood. The employment district is shown in blue and is designated for job producing type industries. Because of the unique nature of needing usually large buffers or large footprints or large parking areas, we don't anticipate that these would be subject to any form of design guidelines, although they would be encouraged. Corridor overlays are areas of the city where, although it's primarily an automobile-oriented use, council has directed us to try to improve the aesthetic of look of that. They've told us that downtown development starts at I-75, and in order to invite people in to the city, we need to try to make it look a little bit more attractive. That's one of the reasons why they hired Merge to do the wayfinding study. I know some of you were able to participate in the initial stakeholder interviews for that initial design for wayfinding and signage. But these haven't been designated yet. They will be shown on the future zoning map. And it's an overlay because it's not a land use category in itself, but it's more of an idea that within a land use that certain design guidelines would be desirable. So that pretty much concludes the land use portion. There's other new policies that were added to the comp plan. I mentioned before that Objective 1 deals with just adopting the Vision 2035 by reference. Objective 2 talks about the duties and responsibilities of the 2035 leadership group, who still meets on a monthly basis. Objective 3 is the community area plan process, where we've already gone through that with the West Ocala community, and it provides the direction for the city to plan the other neighborhoods so that they also receive some specific details and how they could develop in the future. Objective 9 speaks to some of the new design guidelines. But these are, they're very soft at this point. There's no numeric criteria in them, and you really don't want to have that in your comprehensive plan. That's more of a land development code issue, because you have to go through a more inflexible process to change your comprehensive plan. So it's very ordinal. It's you know, you'll have shorter buildings or taller buildings rather than specific dimensions. So that provides staff and applicants with much more flexibility when they come in with a project, rather than hard absolute numbers. As Mike mentioned, we will be adding a new historic preservation goal to the future land use element in replacement of the standalone historic preservation element, which was always optional, but a very good thing to have for a city with many historic resources like Ocala. This has been reviewed by the Ocala Historic Preservation Advisory Board, and they send their recommendation on to you. There are six new objectives, although they are substantially similar to the previous historic preservation element. The first being to heighten appreciation for all citizens of the historic and cultural heritage of the city, to encourage property owners, especially those with properties on the National Register or locally designated districts, to keep their properties in good repair, to beautify and physically upgrade historic the Ocala Historic District, to increase public awareness of both the Tuscaloosa Park Historic District and the West Ocala Historic District, and finally to come up with ways to increase positive economic impacts of historic preservation. How can that benefit the city in a fiscally beneficial way? So our next steps, you know, provided that this board and city council approve the future land use map and element, we're working with staff on a new zoning map that, as I mentioned, condenses the existing 35 plus zoning categories down to about 15, again, to make it a little bit more manageable for developers, for applicants, property owners, for staff, rather than having a R3 AAA zoning district. It could be a little bit more concise and simpler. There are certain areas of the city that would have adopted, with adopted community plans, that could be candidates for form-based codes. What staff is looking at now is doing one in perhaps the downtown area where the downtown master plan was already conducted, as well as the West Ocala community, where we just completed a community plan that was adopted and supported by the community. And we also added a new policy that describes how, because we're in a transitional process and there may be some conflicts with the other elements, this describes how the future land use element, or the current proposed one, overrides the other elements in terms of if there's any conflicts with nomenclature. Here's a copy of the draft consolidated zoning map. We don't really want to spend any, you know, much of your time here other than to say it's a work in progress, and we're trying to simplify the zoning map of the city while respecting all private property rights. It's actually a pretty complicated issue, but staff has been working very hard on it to make sure that nobody loses any property rights. Before I move on to transportation, any questions on land use at this point?
Any questions?
Okay, thank you.
We've heard most of that before already, so.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Okay, part two, transportation element. As we mentioned before, there's minor updates throughout for clarification, consistency, and nomenclature, but there's also several new major ideas that came from the Vision 2035 planning process. And as you said, you've heard much of this before, so I'll just start going through it. One of the big changes is to make all roads, all local roads within the city, level of service E. I know you guys had some questions about what does level of service mean. So rather than showing a engineering graphic, because I found some good ones, but they really only speak to transportation engineering and not to land use. So I think it's important not to get wrapped too much up in what that means, but generally, Level of service E, you could say it means efficient. We've got full use of our roadway. It's not an A, which would be a highway characteristic where you've got people blazing through town as fast as they can. And it's not an F condition either, where traffic has ground to a standstill. And the intent of reducing or changing the level of service to E is to provide more capacity for development. Previously, if the city had a level of service standard that was C or D, and a new project came in and they tripped the threshold in terms of the number of trips that were put on the road, they may not be able to move forward without doing some mitigation, some transportation mitigation. So what this does is it provides a little bit more space or more room for new development and putting more trips on the same road. One of the second major changes is to put into place the a mobility plan and fee to replace the concurrency management system. A mobility fee allows applicants or developers to pay a proportion of an improvement that the city would have a system set up so they could pay a certain proportion for a project rather than not being able to move forward. This will be set up to encourage development in specific locations. They could pay into different types of mobility improvements. It wouldn't just be for roadways. It could be for other forms of transportation, promoting compact mixed use and energy efficient development. And it would not assess these new developers for current backlogs. So that's a good thing for them. This is something that is going to be phased. We're not trying to institute this overnight, but it would be adopted by the end of 2013. So at that point, the concurrency management system would be eliminated. And again, this is to provide more flexibility for the city, for staff, for developers, for property owners. So instead of having to stop once you meet a certain numeric threshold, they'd be able to move forward with some flexibility. Objective 7 is the complete streets concept that we described to you before. So this is designing roads not just for the comfort of people who sit inside their automobiles, but for all users, which could be people on foot, people on bikes, people within transit, and making sure there is space to accommodate transit. So that is the concept behind objective number 7. Objective 8 is to create a road diet program. And this is, I think we brought up the Pine Avenue project before, where it's got 6 or 7 lanes of capacity, but really only operates with a need for 4. And that's something that the TPO has also predicted over a 20-year period, that it will only need 4 lanes of capacity. So there's an opportunity there, and the DOT is actually working with the consultant now to explore it a little bit further. But since that is a potential redevelopment corridor, to try and reduce the number of lanes within that street, make it a little bit safer, make it easier for pedestrians or cyclists to cross the street, or if you're in a car too, it might be a little easier, and create a better pedestrian environment along that corridor that right now separates East and West Ocala, or West Ocala from downtown. Here is a location map of some of the potential projects. The commission has seen this before. It hasn't changed. And again, here are some of the illustrative graphics of how complete streets or road diets could occur. These graphics won't be a part of the comprehensive plan, but they're meant to be illustrative for public education. Here's 40 showing a more urban section where you've got tree wells and wide sidewalks rather than the kind of suburban planting that exists today with longer grass strips that take a little bit of maintenance dollars. The section number 2 shows a pedestrian refuge in an island, which provides a little bit more safety for people trying to cross, for example, from south of 40 to north of 40. And we've heard a lot of people say that they'd like to see north of 40 also have the ability to have some economic development that it hasn't seen in the past. This is a concept showing Pine Avenue being reduced from 6 lanes down to 4 lanes, which mathematically we know works based on projected traffic counts, and also allows for a tighter urban redevelopment condition. The bottom image shows MLK looking north. This is an area where, working with the community, they said we'd like to see more of a Main Street section than a 4 or 5 lane thoroughfare. So that's a concept that we looked at that could potentially work for that area, but would require a little bit more detailed engineering study. As we mentioned, the concurrency management system is proposed for deletion, and therefore you also don't need the concurrency exception area, which encompass downtown. The new Growth Management Act, eliminate the need for concurrency, so the city is following through with that. Any questions on transportation before we move to recreation?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's a little bit premature because it's not policy time yet, but how do you foresee the mobility fee working? I mean, how is it going to be assessed? My concern is, you know, with impact fees, you can structure it so that it's really proportional to the benefit to the developer and the impact the developer's requiring when they come in. With the mobility fee, I mean, is it shared by the community at large, a general fund expenditure, or is this going to be like a user fee, like an exaction on each new developer?
Well, I wouldn't call it an exaction. It is a user fee, and it's based on proportionate number of trips leaving a site. So if you have a project that has internal capture, because you mix uses, you may have a less trips leaving the site, so you may have a lower mobility fee. What the city does is they create a overall program of needed mobility improvements throughout the city, so they can estimate this is the total cost of what we need to do throughout the city, and an applicant would be able to pay into a portion of them. That's how most of them are structured. Whereas an impact fee, it's kind of a flat fee, and it doesn't matter what your project is, you're still going to be assessed the same thing. With a mobility fee, it's a little bit more flexible.
Okay, but are the road diet projects going to be paid for through this mobility fee structure?
They could be, potentially.
So, I mean, a concern, practically speaking, we're charging, you know, new developers who under the premise that, you know, they need to pay a fee because they're attracting more trips, and then paying to reduce the size of the roads that those trips mm-hmm. are.
It could be the road diet could also be paid by, it could be a DOT grant or funding, which I believe is what they're looking at for the current project. So there's a variety of funding sources. I think you would mostly see operational improvements, like a new turning lane or signal retiming or something like that from the mobility fee, but it's yet to be structured. And really it's an emerging science that has really been promulgated by the state legislature. But I can assure you that the city of Ocala isn't the only one that's looking into this funding mechanism. So people aren't going to say, well, I'm going to go build somewhere else because they don't have a mobility fee. Really, everybody's trying to develop one now.
And I'm just thinking of, and I not appear as a lawyer or anything, but for, you know, in terms of the constitutionality of impact fees and your ability to levy those user fees on developers, I mean, it has to be proportional to the impact.
Yes.
And it has to benefit that developer in a somewhat direct manner. And if we're saying, well, you're bringing in more necessary capacity for our roadways, so we're going to exact a fee, and then we're going to use those funds to make a 6-lane road a 4-lane road that has some, you know, some, and I love the beautification ideas. I think that's great, but paying, you know, using those types of fees to beautify Pine Street doesn't meet the constitutional test in my mind.
Okay.
So we just need to be careful on the policy side of that. And to be honest, I have my reservations on the front end of it, just because we're encouraging policy to go down that road, knowing that I don't know how you make that work. I think
those are great points, and we'll have to investigate that once it's time to develop the actual structure of the program.
Okay.
I would like to add to what he said. From a businessman's standpoint, that we're going to get, that I'm going to get charged to develop my property on the amount of traffic that comes in, and wherever the money comes from, it's going to be spent to decrease the amount of traffic that can get to my business that generated the revenue for you to go in and put the road on a diet so less people can conveniently get there, is going to concern me.
Understood.
Drastically. That just, I've seen it happen in Gainesville because I'm up there quite a bit. It's, it hasn't helped anybody. It's pretty.
I wouldn't say it's going to decrease the total amount of traffic. It may decrease the surge at which it comes through, the speed, certainly.
And my only concern with the current, like with current traffic counts, I just know, and a lot of properties I've looked at, when you look back at the historical data since, say, 2008, you've seen a fairly steady decline in daily trips. And so I just, you know, I feel like we should probably be pretty careful, especially when it comes to a pine, if we're saying that, you know, now the trips are down a little bit, knowing that, you know, a lot of that is due to the economy. And if things hopefully get better, that we can probably expect to see those trips increase. So, I mean, that would be my only concern, because I know it's happening in a lot of places that are significantly developed areas, whether it be down in the villages or wherever, where actually trips have been decreasing pretty steadily. So
the data we've received from Mr. Slay at the TPO indicates that they've projected out for 20 years and they see, and of course you have to understand where that, you know, you're looking backwards to project forward, and it's not an exact science, but their understanding is that it will remain steady for the next 20 years, and it has operated the same way in the past. And I know when DOT does their study, they will also, they're even more concerned about the numbers than I am, so they will not let that go.
Yeah, I just want to make sure everybody knows. I mean, we are, the traffic counts are down, but they're only down for the past few years. And up until that point, they were increasing pretty steadily. Mm-hmm. So I'd hate to drop down to four lanes and then all of a sudden, 5 years later, oh, we need six lanes again. So
I'd like to comment on that also. The trips on Pine Avenue haven't shown an appreciable gain over the last decade and a half, so those trips really haven't gone up. And one of the other things, and we talked about this a little bit at the last meeting, is that if you did go down four lanes, it would allow you to make some of the operational improvements. And many of the failures, especially in the peak hour on Pine at 464 and at 40, are related as much to the operational issues as it is to the actual capacity of the roadway. So actually going down to four could help with some of those issues. But like Kurt said, the next step in this process would be a feasibility study by DOT. So they're going to go in addition to actually examining the roadway, they're also going to be inviting members of the stakeholders that live along 441 or own property along there to get more public feedback. So certainly anything we do in terms of moving forward with the road diet isn't something that's going to happen right away. There will be a lot of study prior to us moving forward with it.
You said there's a lot of places looking into this. Has anybody instituted a mobility fee that you're aware of?
The closest I can think of is the city of Eustis. And I'd have to come back with you with some more specifics, but Lawrence Lewis, one of our other planners, has worked with them for the last several years, and they are also developing their mobility fee.
We've also, Pete and I have gone to a DOT seminar, actually, in Pinellas County, Pasco County, the city of Tampa. There's a number of other cities and counties in the state that have done mobility fees.
And how are they set up? I mean, more specifically, I mean, in terms of, are they levied on new development? Is that how they're assessed?
Yeah, they're levied on new development. And one of the things that if you have a mobility fee and that we've talked about is that it gives you more flexibility. So if there are certain areas, like we've, you know, talked a lot about the downtown during this whole process, you know, there could be different fees associated with development in the downtown as opposed to other areas of the city. So it could basically be used try to incentivize development in the areas that you're looking to add a lot of growth. and that's how they're set up. For example, in Pinellas County, that's how it's set up. There's certain areas that they don't charge any mobility fee, and then there's other parts of Pinellas County where they charge a higher fee for the same type of development.
What are, if you would just list from the top of your head, the both the pros and the cons of the traffic calming, which that's one of the effects of the road diet.
Okay.
Would you just give it, based on the research, the studies, and I mean, traffic calming has been being done for quite some time now. Is there some data to say, okay, this is what the result is?
I have data for Atlantic Avenue and Delray Beach. I don't have those numbers with me, but they've seen some appreciable increases in their tax revenue. They're also within a community redevelopment area, which I know certain areas of the city are or will be, but they've done the beautification you mentioned. One thing it does is it shows a physical investment in an area for new development to come in, because they see that this is an area of priority, and it's an area where they know that infrastructure will be provided and sufficient use for their development. Other pros, you mentioned traffic calming, you know, increased comfort for pedestrians or others. You know, some of the cons could be the cost of landscaping or of maintaining the landscaping materials if they're not done efficiently. Sometimes businesses do have some issues with visibility for the signers that they want, or you know, to make sure that we're not blocking the storefront. So that's a process you need to work through with the business owners, and that's something that the city certainly wants to do.
Okay, and you mentioned, just to clarify in my own mind, that the road diet, does that actually, generally speaking, reduce the number of trips, or does it just slow the traffic down? Is there a correlation?
It may reduce the number of trips if people decide to take a different route. Okay. That's always possible. It can slow traffic down. You don't always eliminate a lane, although in Pine, that's something that we are proposing, just because of the data that we do have that it operates at 4. You could reduce the width of the lanes themselves, just reducing them a foot from your standard 12-foot to an 11-foot lane can have a difference on the speed and give you some more room on the outside. I know it's only a foot or two, but it adds up. Provide more landscape space or more sidewalk space, so that's some of the options you can do. Or you could stripe a lane for bicycles to remove that from automobile use.
Okay. So if it's reducing trips on one hand, I'm supposing that would be through trips, that, you know, trips that people have no intention of stopping. They're just going from point A to point B. But you also said that the studies show that it increases
it could
traffic down to, you know, attracting more people downtown. So would it be a stretch to say that it reduces through trips but creates more destination in trips? People going directly to downtown for the purpose of
that's the intent
downtown.
Of it to cater to those who are going to stop and use the facilities or the businesses rather than those that are passing through.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, recreation and parks element. This element is the major changes here are to incorporate the 2010 recreation and parks master plan that we worked on with Ms. Kreil and her staff over for about 6 months or so. This plan, the policy calls for it to be reviewed every 5 years, and really focuses on improving public health through walking, connectivity to parks, and safe ways to get to parks and schools and residences. One of the major policies that was added was to develop a greenways and bicycle pedestrian trails master plan. So the policy calls on the city to identify general trail routing, identify a general trails cross section, and to look at, you know, how the city would fund and construct that actual trail system. One of the major changes is changing the level of service standard to 4.6 acres per 1,000 residents for both community and neighborhood parks. And that would be maintained over 5 different regional park service areas. So you couldn't have all of your parks on one side of the city and another side of the city doesn't have anything, but because it averages out, then everybody's okay. That's the intent, is to make sure it's evenly distributed throughout the city. And this is a change from the previous level of service standard, and many communities are getting away from the older way of saying, you know, we want to have one picnic table per 250 residents, and we want to have one swimming pool per 1,000 residents. What this does is it provides flexibility for parks and recreation programming to be able to meet the needs of the community through park acreage, and then they can determine what are the recreational needs within that acreage, rather than being, you know, held hostage by a new swimming pool or a new picnic table or a ball field. All those things will come as long as you have the acreage in place. We've also added a new culture and arts policy in Objective 8, and that's really to foster the creative community within the city and support the Municipal Arts Commission, develop art and public places programs, and encourage the establishment of a community art and art organization database, and of course continue coordination with our best friends, the 2035 Leadership Group. As Mike mentioned, existing comprehensive plan elements that are recommended for deletion are the community redevelopment area. This was an optional element previously. As you know, the city is looking at creating 3 new community redevelopment areas, and those will be adopted by local ordinance, so it's really not necessary to have an element. The future land use element policies, we think, already encourage redevelopment and the use of those alternative funding sources, so the element itself wasn't needed. And as we mentioned, the historic preservation element would be transitioned into the future land use element, and the current one deleted. So we're requesting from the Planning and Zoning Commission a recommendation for approval to City Council. Right now we are scheduled for a public hearing before City Council on April 3rd, although I'm told that may change based on certain conditions, but that's the current schedule. So we're happy to take any questions.
Any more questions? You're good.
Thank you.
We will open it up if anybody's got anything to add to that nice presentation. You guys are here for a reason.
Good evening. Steve Gray, 125 Northeast First Avenue, Suite 1, Ocala. I've applied my standard rule, which is to sift through and find things that are peculiar to what I'm working on or think I'm going to be working on. But most of these would be issues that would also exist in general. And let me open with several comments about experience with comprehensive plans and amendments to comprehensive plans. I am not conceptually opposed to a form-based plan. I think there are some general principles, though, that in my experience, having gone through in multiple jurisdictions, comp plan reviews and work, is number one is I don't think it's a very good idea to piecemeal the adoption of an amended plan. In other words, if you have all your elements together, it's much easier to move it forward. I have some concern about just adopting certain elements, leaving other elements open. But that's just a sort of something you'll have to talk to your consultants about and decide whether you really want to get into that. The one thing I see about this is that if you adopt a map, it has a provision that says that the future land use element will control the other elements until they're adopted. we're going to be in, it appears to me, we would be in a little bit of another world here with the adopted map, not all the other elements adopted, and also not having literally zero text in the zoning code or the land development regulations until those are adopted. So I'm not certain that it's the greatest idea to adopt, to send for transmittal to the DC, to the former DCA, now the development of the Division of Community Development. I'm not sure it's a good form idea to send a map and not have all of your documentation in the transmittal package. You know, the process and the statute, the year process, which some of y'all have worked through year processes before, contemplates that you don't get a chance to do it in pieces. It's done in bulk for that very reason. But with those comments, which are really more procedural than substantive, I'd like to go over a couple of substantive comments. One thing, and this is a comment that would apply to several areas in here. There are a number of areas in here that says that the city shall implement, and in some situations it has a date specific. In others, it does not have a date specific. You need to either have date specific or not have date specific, but I think date specific are better, because I have had more than a few appeals of comprehensive plan amendments because, for instance, Marion County in 1992 adopted a provision saying that they would basically adopt a transfer of development rights provision to preserve the value of farmland. Dr. Weber was sort of representing the farm community in the original, and that never occurred. Well, eventually we began to see that in some of the litigation we were having over a comprehensive plan. People would go through the plan, and everything that it said you would adopt, if it didn't have a date specific where they could, they would say, well, you know, that would, if you haven't adopted it, you cannot amend your comprehensive plan. So I think you're better to have a date specific. If anything, that also imposes on the government, which can be as bad a procrastinator as I am or worse, that imposes on the government a timeline to do things. And if you just have, and if you go through, you're gonna see there's sections that say by such and such a date you'll adopt. And that's contrary to a basic premise of drafting these type regulations, which is this. A drafting rule is that if two rules are drafted in a different form, or if you had three rules and two of them are drafted with exactly the same language, the third has a different language, you assume that there's some intent that third rule is different than the other two rules. And so I would recommend that you think about putting dates for all of city shall implement, city shall do this. Otherwise, we're going to have a plan that has city will implement, in some cases, no dates. My next comment, and this is a general comment on several locations here. For instance, on page 7 of the future land use element, it's talking about low intensity. Now, low intensity is a pretty important land use classification in this map, because it really includes what I would say will be the developing commercial center of Ocala, which is what's left of Heathbrook, the property around the West Marion Community Hospital and that zone out there on State Road 200. And there is a lot of activity that some of you may not have seen, but there is a lot of activity right now in that area. And so there's going to be a lot of activity. But this one says, so for instance, the second paragraph says, low intensity is characterized by buildings that are 1 to 3 stories in height. And I'm not quite sure what characterized means. Does that mean there's a 3-story height limit in low intensity? I don't think that's what you want, because you can already look at Heathbrook. For instance, hotels are all over 3 stories. you really would not want, I think, low intensity in general to be limited to three stories, because we need to have a little more vertical development here to help us out on our urban sprawl. But this is a term that is used throughout the draft. It'll talk about areas being characterized by, and I don't think that really, this is where you begin to diverge between the planning language and beginning to really view the future land use map. I know the element is more of a planning tool than an ordinance, but it does raise in my mind a question as to if it's just a description, then I would propose it doesn't need to be in there because it's not giving you a definition as to where you're going in the future. It is by definition a future land use map, so I don't think you need to describe particularly as much what it was. I think it's describing what you want the city to be over the near future. And so I'm not sure we want to say 1 to 3 stories in height for low intensity. I mean, I'm certain we don't want to say three-story height limitations in low intensity. The next is on the bottom of page 10, still in the future land use element. And the question here is, this is in a residential, this is basically a neighborhood category, but in neighborhoods you have some ability to have commercial. And it describes it as limited neighborhood scale commercial, which is a little bit unclear and I think needs some clarification. The question is, who would decide what is neighborhood scale commercial? Now, I understand the planning scheme, if we want to call it a scheme or a plan, here is to limit commercial to corners, not have radial development where you go all the way from one corner to another. I am concerned that you have language that says, do not overwhelm anyone's street. Corner businesses should be dispersed with a multiple block separation. Well, I don't think anybody would have any clue as to what that means, really. Does multiple block mean a 2-block, 3-block? These are items that become very important to property owners later, or to property owners who, when it comes time for the adoption hearing and they go starting to look at the text and figure out what they can do on their property, and they look at this and they say, well, does that mean I have to be 3 blocks, 4 blocks more or more? I think that is more of a concept language, and it's consistent with some of the other language. You know, previously, in addition to multiple block separation, it says that uses should be located on collector roads or block corner lots, and generally not within a half a mile of each other. That language is a little bit problematic. Now, in the employment center provisions, page 13, this is a hard comment. In the third paragraph under policy 6.5, it says provisions should, which I think they may intend to be using the word shall, should be made for walking bicycles and inner city rail transit. This would technically require that you make provisions for inner city rail transit. I don't know if that means to dedicate a future right-of-way, but I have obviously employment center projects, and I don't believe that inner city rail transit should be in here, particularly if this is a mandatory provision, which the word should. It's either editorial or it is mandatory. The other comment I have here is I have some concerns about the mixture with residential, which which is not a which I will concede is not a primary use. Their primary uses are industrial and office and commercial, and residential is not a primary use, but I would request that we delete the intercity rail transit reference. We talked earlier about policy 11.2, which is the interim period prior to the next year update. The year update is forthcoming, is it not? The next.
That's where our year, when everything happened with DCA, ours was pushed back to August of 2012. So then from August 2012, we have a year.
Yeah, we're pretty close. We're pretty close on the year update. I guess the LUBO provisions, this is on page 19, or would apply only to existing DRIs, I guess, since we are a dense urban land area, a DULA, and the city therefore will not have new DRIs. But included in that policy, and the reason I'm bringing this up is we're in the middle of doing a LUBO on the, what I call the Magnesite project of Ocala, the large commerce park on US 27. It says that under this policy, and this is consistent with what they currently do for a LUBO, you have to be a mixed-use PUD zoning classification. And it says that the city shall adopt the appropriate provisions in the plan development code for the processing approval of a mixed-use PUD. I've been requesting half-heartedly for the last 10 years, I'd say, that the city update its PUD ordinance, because really the city PUD ordinance is an old, first of all, you very seldom see PUD ordinances anymore. They're normally a plan development. But the city PUD ordinance currently is simply the old residential with the tack-on language that says, by the way, you can do a mixed use. And where that creates problems for us is explaining to people who are not local what they can do in a mixed use PUD in the city and not having a definite roadmap of the actual ordinance. So on that one, which is on page 20, I would say that since you need to have a PUD to make use of the LUBO, and they obviously recognize that they need provisions to process and approve a mixed-use PUD, that needs to be by a date certain or concurrent with the first adoption of land development regulations. This is a little note on policy 12.2. This language may be contrary to a Florida statute, I believe it is. It says that the city shall permit new industrial development when it has city sewer lines available concurrent with industrial development with sufficient capacity. I guess this means that industrial development would not be undertaken unless the city had sewer lines to the site. Now that would be slightly contrary to a Florida statute which says as follows, even if I'm in the city's utility service area, if the city does not have utility services available to me and I need those services, I can provide what we call a one-year letter and notification to the local government that says, hey, I'm here, I'm going to need sewer 1 year from this date. What the statute does is if the city does not extend the sewer and get the capacity to you, it makes you the equivalent of a free agent. And you then have the ability, if you can get sewer extended from another provider that would satisfy the treatment requirements. I believe that policy 12.2, I understand a little bit of the intent. It wants you to do commercial development, industrial development concurrent with the availability of sewer capacity. But if you think about it, you're going to have a new industrial development on the edge of the city. And when you're on the edge of the city, you're also on the edge of another big service area, which currently they don't have much capacity to give you, which is the county. But if we are all trying to incentivize as much industrial development as possible, you want to make it easier for some industrial user to get sewer. And sometimes having the ability to give a one-year letter to a sewer provider is an elixir that helps them find ways to get service to that site. So I think you need, I would suggest maybe you need to think a little bit about that section. And I'll follow this up with a written summary of these. You know, I have a question on page 21, which is policy 12.3.1. This is constructing water and sanitary sewer infrastructure outside the city limits. And it requires the developer to pay all costs for extending distribution, collection, and transmission facilities, unless otherwise in the five-year plan. And that language is problematical for this reason. The city really has a lot of excess sewer capacity. They're more likely to be extending sewer lines out into the county than the county intruding into the city. This county doesn't really have anything close. But the language basically is precluding the ability of the city to negotiate a deal with somebody to extend and share the cost. It's saying that the development has to pay all the costs. And I can tell you historically, I have negotiated deals, and I think they've all been pretty good deals for the city, where we've extended sewer lines outside the existing city limits to provide service to other people. And some of the cost of those extensions, one way or another, reimbursements or however we did the deal, some of those costs were borne by the city. By way of example, years ago when we extended water and sewer, city water and sewer to the Ocala Palms project, it was outside the city. They got some reimbursement, so in effect they did not pay all the costs. But it was a good deal for the city because that opened up that entire area, and eventually Publix came in across the street and everything else is out there. This is more of a technical question, and as I said, I'll put it in the memo. And that's really it on specifics in the future land use element. But I would urge you to give some thought to the process of a process of not having all of the elements of the comprehensive plan in front of you in a single transmittal package versus just doing future land use element and transportation. I think we'll then end up, if we're not careful, we're going to end up having so much stuff in the system, keeping track of it and where it is going to be a little bit difficult. I'm sure Mr. Curry has many more comments than I do.
Mr. Gray,
I think we have a question for you.
What do you think about the constitutionality of a mobility fee?
Well, that's going to probably, by the time we get to it, it'll be litigated on, you know, a fair number of fronts. As I understand it, the concept the city somewhat has now is to fund the mobility fee in some fashion by negotiating a deal with the county to get a part of their impact fees. Which I think is pretty optimistic and probably way too optimistic. The county, because they suspended their impact fees, they're running broke now. I suspect by the end of this calendar year they're going to reinstate them, but it'd be hard pressed to get them to release any of their money. But it's the beauty of the legislature. I mean, the legislature declared mobility fees is the way to go. And I think we might have some advantage in that there are people ahead of us on the timeline who are going to get out there with their ideas on how to do it. But I think the general case law that's applicable to a lot of impact fees, which is the fee has to be proportionate to your impact, and it has to benefit you or the area immediately with a reasonable nexus, is what most of the cases say. You know, reasonably close area to where you are makes it, I guess the easiest way to do it is to transition from the impact fee to a proportionate fair share version of the impact fee. But you know, the impact fee is based on the average mile cost, lane mile cost for the entire county. And so the mobility fee may be a lot more specific and defined as to where you are, because depending on where you're developing, your per mile cost or your cost for road improvements could be substantially different than a standard impact fee. I think it's very doubtful that the county is going to easily transition and share in any way, in my opinion, if they're going to want to share any of their impact fees. Over the years, I've consistently had the city staff tell me that the city has always gotten stiffed by the county. I'm not going to subscribe this to any particular staff member, but I've always heard from city staff that they've always been stiffed by the county in doling out and using the transportation impact fees. I've always heard from the county, and I go back and forth all the time between them. I always heard from the county that really the city has gotten more money than what they should have gotten. They've done more projects in the city that were more expensive, and so maybe that tells me the system works. But the county has been very reluctant, and you know, one time there was some thought of litigation. The county's been very reluctant to ever agree to what you see in some areas of the state, which is where they create an urban impact fee district. Basically corresponds to the city limits or something close to that. But we don't. You know, the problem here is the county impact fees are collected for four districts, basically northwest, northeast, southeast, southwest. And so you can have fees collected in the city that are spent 25 miles away. Thanks.
Anyone else?
Good evening. My name is Landis Curry, 21 Northeast First Avenue, Ocala. I have mostly general comments. I've met with staff and attended two of the workshops. The first comment I have is a semantics comment, and that is, with all the words in the English language, how can the primary commercial areas in this whole city be called low intensity use? And you say, well, you can define low intensity use to be whatever you want. But if you're on the other side of an argument and you're arguing against something, you're going to pick up on this thing says it's low intensity use. There's got to be a better word than low intensity use. The word low just isn't correct. And I would suggest some modification that gives a representation of the area that is being affected by that use. I know they're trying to get the number of uses down, but that word doesn't fit. It just absolutely doesn't fit in my mind. There's also mentioned that there's some residential allowed in the low intensity use area. Right now, by way of example, in the commercially zoned area, if you have B2, so B2 property, you have the right to a certain number of residential units. And I can't tell whether there's some sort of vesting that goes with this, or we got to wait and see what happens with the zoning code after it's adjusted. But my clients and Steve and myself and other people in this field are always worried that something's going to slip by, it many times unintentional, and then a client is adversely affected. I'll give you an example. The last time there were major map changes done in the county and the city, I'm talking about the big maps, there were properties that were incorrectly designated or were left out of the category they should have been in. So in an effort to solve that problem, a grandfathering provision was put in to say, well, if we made a mistake, we can fix it. And DCA said, no, when you submit a map and you adopt it, the only way you can change that map is to amend it formally, not informally. So my concern is that there be check, cross-check, back-check. I've got the large map, and I can't tell on a couple of properties of people I represent whether all their stuff's properly included or not. Now, I'm going to work with staff on mine, but my caution is when you adopt this map, you send it to the city council, and city council adopts it. DCA accepts it. You can't go and say, well, wait a minute, your property is in the wrong classification. They won't accept it. They'll make you amend the comp plan, which means you got to file an amendment, you got to pay your fees, and you got to go through the whole process of a hearing and everything. So I caution you to watch for that. On the mobility fee, it's my understanding that the city intends to negotiate with the county to attempt to obtain part of the impact fee to be allocated to the mobility fee. At least that's one of the areas that plan to satisfy that requirement. Which, lots of luck in that quest, in my opinion, in having dealt between the city and the county on these things before. But my real question goes to this. What happens if that avenue an effort fails? The county says no. Impact fees are divided into five districts or four districts, however many they have now, and that's the way it's going to stay. And the city has said, well, we're going to adopt a mobility fee. So I'm assuming the county said no for purposes of discussion. Where do we go to get the money? Aren't we, in essence, putting another impact fee and calling it a mobility fee? And I understand you can define terms the way you want to define them, but from a developer's standpoint, the amount of money you have to pay to develop determines whether you can be successful or not. So I'm concerned that the mobility fee put off until December 2013 it isn't a trap in the long run for property owners who are gonna, when the city says, well, we got to adopt something because it's in our comp plan. It also may go further than that because under Senate Bill 360, which was adopted 2 or 3 years ago, dealing with proportionate share funding when developers want to develop and they need to pay a proportionate share, that bill allows the developer to take a credit, or they can obtain a credit for prior impact fees and future impact fees against the proportionate share. That's my reading of the act. I don't know that it addresses mobility fees. I don't know that anyone contemplated that somebody was going to establish a mobility fee which is a different type of impact fee to me. Now, if we can get part of the money from the county, then maybe I'd change my opinion. But if we don't, sitting on our books is we're going to do a mobility fee. And there's already discussion to encourage growth in the downtown area, that that area may not be charged the same kind of mobility fee that someone out in another area would be charged. So I'm really concerned about that area. The mention of the corridor outlay, and there was some specific roads, I believe, that were named in there. My caution there is that FDOT twice in recent years has come to the city of Ocala and Marion County and basically said, we're going to put medians on certain roads whether you like it or not. State Road 200 was one, 17th Street was another. They had what they called stakeholder meetings, landowner meetings, and that type of thing. I represented people in both of those things. In essence, what they said was, you can make your comments, but we've already decided what we're going to do. We're going to put the medians in, and there's nothing you can do about it. And then for once in the history of local government, the city and the county went together and opposed State Road 200 medians. And to some extent, the 17th Street, although it was more on State Road 200, which resulted in the head of DOT coming over here and apologizing for the way they handle the corridor impact. If we're going to have a corridor overlay of any sort where medians are going to be installed and that type of thing, where there are businesses strung up and down the boulevard, there should be specific meetings in advance of adoption held with all those property owners. They should be have an opportunity to see what's proposed, have their input, and then it'll be considered. People don't read the want ads and the notices and stuff in the newspaper. They make an assumption, which is ill-founded, that no news is good news from government. But a lot of government takes up place up here without any individual notice to affected property owners. So the only way you can get to them, if you're going to do a corridor, is to go to that corridor and have site-specific meetings and explain to them what's proposed and not tell them it's safety and we're going to cram it down your throat. So I just caution the city to make sure that they take that extra step. These workshops we've been to, community meetings, neighborhood meetings, don't get to that point. I just think we need to be very careful about how we impact people who have vested rights to use property. And this is the last place you can come is P&Z and then City Council. And if you notice, there's three or four people here tonight, and this thing affects everybody in the city of Ocala. So, my comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Excuse me. Donald Spott, 615 East Silver Springs Boulevard, Ocala, 34470. I became aware of this about 2 or 3 weeks ago, what was forthcoming. And I have a piece of, I'm part owner of a piece of property that's being affected by that. And it's somewhat concerning to me a little bit. And this piece of property is on a rail line, and it's possibly going to be changed to a point that it cannot maximize the use of a railroad. The rail will still be there, but it concerns me that we're probably not analyzing all the rail possibilities, because I think if you look at the map where the rail lines go through, there is some there's some benefit there in the future if the rail comes back, but it'd be better prepared for it. And I believe that we're getting ready to try to add a track to Magna to take rail out there, and I hate to see it go. I've been here for 45 years, and then in the 70s and 80s, rail was very, very important for our manufacturers here. I mean, there were rail cars here all the time, and that kind of just fizzled away in time, and it just became obsolete. But with the cost of energy and everything that we're confronted with, I'm just thinking there should be some consideration for staff to kind of look at the rail. I mean, I'm not saying they haven't done it, but I mean, I'm just saying there's probably some opportunities there that the community could benefit from. Next thing, another thing in looking at the maps, when we look from the city boundaries going into the county, are some of the land uses that we're developing, are they compatible to the next door neighbor, or is it going to, is there consideration that was involved in that? I didn't have the chance to really ask all these questions to staff, which I would rather be doing, but the clock is ticking. And that's an issue also. Back in 92, in August, when we did the land, had the land use, comprehensive land plan for Marion County and the city, there was some errors there where the land use changed and the city and the county, well, this county didn't, the county didn't do it the same way. The city just changed the zoning just at will. And the thing that semi-concerns me, and I think Steve addressed, Mr. Gray addressed this, is that I'm not so sure if we don't need to have the zoning in place with the land use at the time it happens. And then another question is, if you own property that's in the park district as a private enterprise, how do you benefit from that? I mean, how do you market that? Or do you have to make a park or a playground or something and charge a fee, or amusement park, or et cetera, et cetera? I think that's all I got to say.
Okay. Oh, you got a question?
No.
Sure. Anyone else from the audience? Okay. We'll close that off. Did you guys want to maybe address any of these issues?
Hi, Chick is all the management director, and I appreciate all the comments from the public. We'd be more than happy to meet with the public. I don't want to rush this thing. I don't think it's good to rush. We were waiting for more comments, and I think there needs to be some things that we most probably should address and more clear up some of the issues about the zoning, and maybe we can better explain where we are and what maybe some of that transition period, and also about the concurrency, I mean, in terms of possibly a little bit more about the mobility fee. So I'd be willing to do 30 or 60 days if you want to postpone it,
okay,
to give us more time. And I want y'all to feel comfortable with it, because again, a lot of this should happen at the planning and zoning level and not at the city council level.
Right.
So I think there's some things that the board brought up and the public has brought up that we should be able to address. I don't think none of them are huge. The thing about the comp plan, it would be nice because of the ear. It did mess us up. We were moving forward. We already had reviewed. It was ready to be approved. And then the whole DCA thing changed in last May. And so that's kind of pushed us back. I think what we could do, if we do have that period of time, is we can look at those other elements. There's only a few, like housing, which is really not, won't be much of an issue. The school facilities element, which could go away because of not being mandated, and we're in the process of looking at that. Lisa's working on the CIE. The only really concern was, Mr. Gray mentioned, and I think I had some of this concern, was those water and sewer extension issues, and those are, I think they were done at so many different times, I don't know if they all match up now, so I think we could go back and look at those to see if we can, and those really are the only ones, I would think, in the other elements, the infrastructure elements, that may be somewhat of an inconsistent, but yeah, it would be ideal to do it that way, but because of our limited budget and trying to work with VHB, their contract is not for those other elements, and so those things will have to be done by staff, and some of them are in the process, but like I said, with the year pushing us back, those most probably not going to be done until the fall or next winter.
But. Okay, so it'd be okay to push us back 30 or 60 days?
Yeah, whatever y'all feel.
But in the interim, how do you want to proceed as far as, you know, addressing all the issues that were brought up tonight?
I think it'd be good to maybe have another kind of public meeting, talk it over with the leadership group. We'll have another leadership group most probably at the end of the month. Invite Steve, Lanny, and Don, and anybody else that needs to come forward, and maybe work with them on one-on-one now that we know some of those issues.
Right.
I don't think none of them are major ones. I think we can address those, but I'd be happy to give that amount of time.
Okay. So, anybody got any recommendations on?
Well, can I just ask a question? Practically speaking, before I heard fall or spring, I was thinking this may work out pretty well since we've tackled the biggest, you know, impediment, which is the flu. And maybe once we got that, now that we have the issues pinpointed, while we're working on fixing those issues, the other elements could be wrapped up. Is it your opinion that it wouldn't be until fall or next spring that we could get all the elements presented together in one comprehensive comp plan?
I mean, a lot of them are not going to have major changes to them. We're eliminating the recreation. We're eliminating, not the recreation, sorry, Kathy. We're changing the recreation. We're eliminating historic preservation and the CRA one. And we're also possibly eliminating the schools element, the one we just adopted a couple years ago because of, we're not required to have that. So that's still kind of in the influx. I mean, the biggest one is the infrastructure stuff, is the water sewer elements. And then we have like the conservation stuff, which is not going to most probably change much. I mean, so there's most probably going to be very few changes in those other elements. But like I said, we haven't really been focusing on those as much as trying to wrap up the future land use. The future land use, the transportation, and then because of the recreation, we focus most of our attention on that at this point.
Okay, so I mean, if we table these elements for the time being and have whether it be a 30 or 60 day extension, would you guys be able to take a look and kind of give an estimate of how much time?
Yeah, we have been doing it. We can give you an analysis of kind of what other changes we can do in those other elements. Like I said, the biggest one we could do something with is housing, but I don't think it's nothing that would be inconsistent with any of the plan. And a lot of those elements, those requirements have been de-emphasized through the new, now that DCA's gone and DEO's there and some of the new statute changes, and 9J5 was not incorporated all into the statute. So there's not the need for all those policies that we have. We hopefully make it much shorter.
Do you prefer 30 or 60 days?
It's up to y'all. More than likely 60 days would get us the chance to and keep us still on track. I know we were trying to meet a deadline. We're trying to move forward as quick as possible. At the same time, it won't slow us down in terms of what we're doing with the zoning, and at the same time give us more information to y'all about the zoning. So I think there would be more of a comfort level. I know that is the biggest issue, is most probably that transition between the land use and the zoning.
Do we want to set up some kind of workshop or meeting now, or we want to kind of, you want to kind
of? Well, we could maybe do it at the next meeting, update y'all, okay, kind of where we are with it and any changes, and then shoot for, I think it is May 14th, I think would be the next meeting. So we would table it to the May 14th meeting.
Okay, but as far as getting together with the public and
in that time, we can get with to them and update y'all at the April 9th meeting in terms of what we have done so far. And if we could bring something, we can bring it at that meeting.
I was talking about more about us being able to meet with you guys in the public, you know. I mean, it was good, yeah, hearing all those questions tonight and comments, you know, that were brought up tonight.
I mean, you wanted to have a special workshop, or, I mean, it's...
I know some of these guys might hate to hear that, but I mean, I would like that. I mean,
I know we don't have a big agenda for
do
the
we
night.
Need a workshop, or do we need an invitations to attend the meetings that they're going to be at?
That'd be fine with me, yeah.
So I don't know that we need to orchestrate it as much as we need to attend it.
And that's what I'm trying to get at, is how we kind of want to get to that point, because I think it would help me tremendously to sit there and hear all these comments and kind of work through them and everything and figure out a solution.
We just have to
them.
Public notice them, but yeah, but that'd be cool.
We can meet with the individuals, and then if the agenda is light in April, we can just do this at the beginning of the meeting or come half an hour early.
I would say the first thing we do, let's have that.
Joining them.
Yeah.
Well, kind of meet with Steve and Lanny and a couple other people individually. We'll have that leadership group meeting. We'll invite them at the end of March. And then kind of see where we can go with the meeting in April.
Right.
The progress, and then there's a 5-week period between the April 1 and the May 1, so we should be able to make those changes.
You want a couple more workshops, don't you, Nate?
Yeah,
3-4.
That's great.
Is it?
Well, I mean, I feel like we, you know, if they can have some meetings, and then we can be privy to that information,
right,
by our next meeting,
right,
then it could be something that we could go over.
Right. That's kind of what I'd like to hear those comments and know kind of the questions that are going to be asked before the meeting, so we can kind of, you know.
And the best thing, Peggy can kind of give us the list of what are some of those issues, the concerns, and we'll try to address them one by one, and maybe even try to address some of like the other issues that I think they're will spin off on those.
Okay.
And what, I mean, I know we're talking about a 60-day, and we're talking about the timeline within the next 60 days, but is that under the thinking that within that period we may be able to tackle the other elements, or is that just...
I think we can give you like an overview of what maybe needs to be changed, or what if Steve's worried about some inconsistency, maybe we could say this would be, you know, was there an inconsistency there with some of the infrastructure, which I think about the only inconsistency that could occur would be in the infrastructure.
Yeah, because I mean, I know we're facing a deadline for the year, yeah, on the back end,
and
but
we
if
could,
we can do
and
it's
we can
not
change those. I mean, it's not like we can't. We were going to bring the CIE element because we're updating the chart at the next meeting. We can lump those in with these changes. So if we have to change something in the sewer water element, that's not significant, I think we can do that by May. We're not going to rewrite the whole things by then, I don't think. And a lot of it doesn't need to be. I mean, I don't think we need to reinvent the wheel so much on some of those.
Well, by our next meeting, we can have some kind of a status report as to
where we are with those elements, yeah.
Okay.
We just need a motion.
We need a motion, yeah, to table.
Move to table until the May meeting.
Second.
Okay, yeah, to the May meeting, yes. All right, got a motion and a second. Any discussions on that? Everybody good? All right, call the roll.
Mr. Howell?
Aye.
Mr. Adams?
Aye.
Mr. Batsell?
Aye.
Mr. Gibney?
Aye.
Mr. Schott?
Aye.
Mr. Greiner?
Aye. Very good, okay. So just keep us updated on what we need to do next with that, Ty. Okay, I guess that's it, we're adjourned. Another reason why I like having hard copies. You got nothing to write on.
I know. Well, you got to kind of leave them here anyhow.
No, I know, but still, it's, you know.
No, I need a copy machine.
I still like having something. No, it's funny you said that because I went over.
Oh, I almost sent an email out the other day because I was like, this is too much.
I went and met with them before the meeting. That's what I told them. I like having physical stuff.
Yeah, I don't like 200 pages.
Yes, because I'm not going
to. I don't have time.
Exactly. I agree. I'm not wasting my ink.
I need to get it.
Paper.
Just out of curiosity, does that mean we're going to get the dog and puppy show again?
Yes.
Two more times.
No.
We can kill
Well, we can tell them we don't need to have the whole thing.
No, you're not.
We can kill that.
Yeah. But like the comments that were brought
just
up.
Just about pounded
the thing that we're heading from here on is if there are red lines.
I don't think they want to give the dog and pony show again.
I mean, I don't know if that's.
A red line agreement would be.
I don't know how many times you've seen it on this point. I think that was five or six for me.
I don't think it's been that much, but yeah, it's kind of like at the beginning, it was like, any questions? Like, no.
Yes, would you please? Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, just visually from this point forward, just so we can see what you're doing. That is a